This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. 50 years ago, during the height of the Cold War between the United States and the Soviet Union, Senator Joseph McCarthy's name became synonymous with red-baiting, slander, guilt by association, and smear. In a campaign ostensibly aimed at communists who he believed infested the government and the armed forces, Senator McCarthy used his post as chairman of the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations to subject some of the nation's most accomplished citizens to an often humiliating public inquiry about their friendships, their political beliefs, and their loyalty to the United States. McCarthy became famous for highly publicized hearings, some of them broadcast in the early days of television, but many of us did not know that McCarthy laid the groundwork in secret hearings where hundreds of witnesses appeared. Previously secret transcripts of those sessions were released earlier this week by the United States Senate. If you have a personal experience with this sad chapter of American history, we'd like to hear your story. If you've had a chance to read the transcripts, call and tell us if you think they have something to teach us about the men and women who had to face this inquisition and about the abuse of power, or if you have questions about Senator McCarthy or his era, give us a call. Our phone number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is TOTN@NPR.org. And joining us now is Donald Ritchie, the Associate Historian of the United States Senate, the primary official behind the release of these transcripts. He's with us here in Studio 3A. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
Now, these interviews took place between 1953 and 1954. Why are we just seeing them now?
Well, the Senate has a rule that most of its records open automatically after 20 years, but records that are particularly sensitive, that have personal privacy or national security or investigatory materials, can be sealed for 50 years. And the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigation about 25 years ago decided to invoke that 50-year rule for those records, largely because so many of the witnesses never testified in public session, and they felt that opening the records up would be an invasion of privacy. We had actually been asked by various researchers to have access to those records, and so we had been going down to the National Archives and surveying them back in the 1970s. Now we knew that the records would open in 2003, and about 2 years ago, we approached the committee and suggested that this would be the time to prepare these for publication for the 50th anniversary.
To protect the witnesses, but this was also not the most glorious moment of the United States Senate.
No, but of course the United States Senate ultimately censured Senator McCarthy for his behavior, and they also changed the rules of investigation. So there was some positive outcome from, in terms of the long run of investigations that go on Capitol Hill.
Now, what was the stated purpose of these sessions, and what do you think McCarthy's objectives were?
Well, it's interesting to me that the year before Senator McCarthy became chairman of the subcommittee, it had held 6 executive sessions. And the first year that he was chairman, it held 130. Obviously, he was using it as a very different tactic than his predecessors had used. Usually, executive sessions are for sensitive materials, for preliminary to the public hearings. But I think Senator McCarthy was using them, in a sense, as a dress rehearsal for what he would do when he went into the public sessions.
And he would call these people in, this was theoretically to look for communists in the government, but then how do you get Dashiell Hammett, the great mystery writer, in there?
Well, his committee normally looked into corruption, waste, contract issues. There was actually another committee of the Senate that looked into internal security issues. That was the Senate Internal Security Subcommittee of the Judiciary Committee. But Senator McCarthy interpreted his jurisdiction very broadly. He said, my committee has jurisdiction over anything that the government does, and therefore I can investigate subversion and espionage in the government. And in the case of Dashiell Hammett and other writers, the closest they came to the government, they weren't government employees, but they had written books that had wound up on the shelves at U.S. information libraries. And instead of bringing in the director of the libraries, which would be the traditional senatorial way, Senator McCarthy subpoenaed the authors of the books and asked them whether or not they thought their own works really deserved to be on the shelves in an information library. Did they still adhere to what they had written in the 1930s? What were their politics? Had they signed petitions? Had they ever joined the Communist Party? Subjected them to that kind of a barrage of asking personal questions about their political thoughts and their backgrounds, and then often asking them to denounce their own writing.
Mm-hmm. Now, in addition to the rather thin reasons for calling people like Dashiell Hammett or Langston Hughes or Aaron Copland into these sessions, he sometimes did them on very short notice. Somebody would be notified 12 hours in advance at 9 p.m. to appear the next day at 9 a.m.
Some of the witnesses say there was a knock on the door at 9 o'clock at night and someone handing them a subpoena and they had to appear the next day. If you're a fairly prominent person, you might have access to a counsel that you could immediately get a hold of and get to the hearing. But for many of the average folks who get called up, they spent much of the night looking for an attorney. Sometimes they only got an attorney in the hallway outside of the hearing. They would find an attorney who was there to represent another client, and they would ask if they would sit in on their session as well. Many of the witnesses show up with no counsel at all. And in some cases, the senator will give them an extra day or two to find a counsel. But in other cases, they feel that since they haven't done anything, they can speak honestly, and they sit down and start to talk. And then they realize how dangerous that is to be before a congressional committee without a counsel.
And start to talk. And what were the consequences of not talking?
Well, you know, many of the lawyers recommended that witnesses take the Fifth Amendment, because once you opened yourself up and once you admitted that you had been to a communist meeting or joined the Communist Party or had done anything that was what you might call a fellow traveler operation in the 1930s, in a time when things were very different, then the next question would be, well, who did you associate with in those days? And that would mean sometimes naming the names of family members, friends, college roommates. Many of these witnesses really did not want to be in a situation of being informing on colleagues from a decade or two decades earlier. And the only way to avoid that often was to take the Fifth Amendment.
And one thing that I don't think people understand a lot about the Fifth Amendment, unless you start taking it right away, once you start talking, you got to keep talking.
Exactly. Once you've opened yourself up to a line of inquiry, then you cannot invoke it. Senator McCarthy also interpreted the Fifth Amendment that if you did invoke it, it was an admission of guilt, and in which circumstance then you could be liable to be suspended from your job if you held a government job, if you were a school teacher, if you worked in a defense contract, any kind of a corporation that had any government contracts, and you took the Fifth Amendment, the likelihood is you would be suspended from your job.
Our telephone number again is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, our email address, totn@npr.org. And Paul joins us on the line from Livermore, California.
Hi, Neil.
Hi.
Say, I actually heard your guest yesterday, and he was...
I think on Monday, but go ahead.
Well, how eloquent Langston Hughes was in front of Senator Everett, and I was wondering if he could just say a few lines of Langston Hughes's...
testimony.
Deposition.
Yeah. This, of course, you're speaking of Senator Everett Dirksen, but go ahead.
Right. Oh, yeah. Right. Everett Dirksen, that's it.
That was an interesting hearing. That was the same hearing that Dashiell Hammett, Jerry Mangione, and a woman writer named Helen Goldfrank all testified. Senator Dirksen was sitting in for Senator McCarthy. Senator McCarthy tended not to allow witnesses to complete their sentences. He wanted yes or no answers to his questions. He tended to interrupt them constantly while they were talking. Whereas Senator Dirksen acted more in the traditional mode of a senator. He had a witness before him. He wanted the witness to be able to explain himself. And in the case of Langston Hughes, Roy Cohn is interrogating Hughes about his philosophy in the 1930s, 1932, some of the poetry he wrote early in his career. Langston Hughes says, well, to explain that poetry, I have to tell you about my life. And he goes back to talk about being a child in a segregated America and the pain and suffering that he had gone through and why his politics, especially in the depth of the Depression, were much more radical in those days than they were by the time that he got to the 1950s, especially after he'd been to the Soviet Union and been quite disillusioned by what he found in the Soviet Union. Roy Cohn keeps trying to interrupt him. He's very impatient, obviously, with this long answer. But Senator Dirksen allows him to speak, and it's a wonderful testimony. It's any biographer would love to see this kind of information coming from someone explaining themselves, defending themselves. And in many ways, if Senator McCarthy had allowed his witnesses to defend themselves in that way, it would have been a more valuable give and take. Instead, he approached it as a prosecution. And he, in many cases, was trying to get the witnesses to incriminate themselves, not to explain what their background was.
At one point, Hughes is being asked to shorten his responses, and he replies, "I would much rather preserve my reputation and freedom than to save time."
That's the one I remembered, yeah.
Yeah. Well, thanks very much for the call, Paul.
Okay, bye.
Let's get a call now from Dan, and Dan's on the line with us from Pensacola, Florida.
Yeah, my father, John Gilman, he was a highly decorated soldier from World War II. In fact, he almost got the congressional honor, but they only have so many to hand out a year. But he got pulled in front of them, and he did a little homework before he went in front of them, found out their military careers. And he was talking earlier about not letting them talk. This guy, you have to let him talk. And he went down the line with them, and they tried to interrupt him. But like I said, when he starts going, he goes and he told them that, you know, such and such you were for aft, and the other guy, you know, got out on a, something wrong with your knee or something. Yeah, he found out that almost all of them up there had got around going into the military. So they were scared to death to have him up there, I think. And he at the end, I think he said something like what he told him. He says, I'm not afraid of the Nazis. I'm not afraid of you.
Dan, do you remember whether that was this particular set of hearings or in the Army McCarthy hearings, which were a little bit later?
I think it's the earlier ones.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing to go along with it, I don't know if this is appropriate or not, but I think that they could do it again, because if it worked before, it could work again. They say if you don't learn from history, you're condemned to repeat it. Now, you guys hold about 10% of the audience, you know, in America, maybe that much. I mean, then people wouldn't put up with it, but the majority of the people would probably go for it again if it was hyped up enough.
Well, Donald Ritchie, first on the first question, which set of hearings do you think that was from?
Well, actually, Senator McCarthy spent a lot of time looking into the Army in various ways, civilian employees in the Army as well as the Army Signal Corps at Fort Monmouth. A lot of military officers testified over time. We will be putting out a cross-reference index to these, and for the time being, these are available online, and I'm sure that some kind of word searching could be done to identify particular witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
There are other investigative committees at the time, however, and many people identify things with McCarthy that actually were held before the Senate Internal Security Subcommittee or the House Un-American Activities Committee. Senator McCarthy gave his name, McCarthy, to McCarthyism, and to some degree, in retrospect, we ascribe everything that happened in that decade to him. These hearings show exactly which hearings he was dealing with. But he did take on the United States Army, and in fact, it was his treatment of Army officers that eventually caused much of his public standing to decline, that in 1954, he's interrogating General Ralph Zwicker, General Zwicker declines to provide him with the information he's seeking because there is an executive order from the president saying that he cannot release this kind of personnel material. Senator McCarthy is furious. Of course, General Zwicker is literally just following orders, but Senator McCarthy says, "You're not fit to wear the uniform of your nation." That transcript was released at the time because much of what happened leaked out to the press, and so they provided the full transcript at the time. And that really triggered some of Senator McCarthy's downslide. Even the Chicago Tribune, which editorially had been supporting him, turned against him in an editorial and said that he had to learn the difference between being an investigator and being an avenging angel. And in fact, it was his browbeating of General Zwicker that eventually led to the Army McCarthy hearings, which were televised and which did undermine much of his public standing.
Mm. Dan, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Earlier, he was also interviewing a lot of these people. You know, again, we talk about Langston Hughes and Dashiell Hammett and Aaron Copland, very famous people. But a lot of the people who were in these witnesses were clerks or unknown people in the Army Corps of Engineers.
Mm-hmm. Engineers secretaries or guards at the gate or blue-collar assembly line workers. It's quite surprising. As the investigation went on, it got down to the average citizen level. In the beginning, it started out with high-level government officials. And in many cases, those are the people who are used to testifying before congressional committees. They don't need a counsel. They're there officially. They can respond in their own way. But these other folks, they were really rolled over by the steamroller.
We're talking about Senator Joseph McCarthy and new information about his campaign against communism inside America. And we're taking your calls. 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. You can also send us email. The address is TOTN@NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Our topic most of this hour is Senator Joseph McCarthy's fight against communism. Here's a bit of McCarthy speaking in 1954, giving the names of those whom he suspected of being communists.
All of them, after they appeared before the committee, were either fired or suspended. Let's run through the names. W. Powell, Robert Goodwin, Edward Rothschild, Nathaniel Mills, Henry Archdeacon, Donald Morrill, Wittelod Pierkarski, R. Levine, Alexander Gregory, Theodore Pappas, Victor Bowles, Irving Perez, that name I imagine is familiar, Sidney Friedlander, Robert Northrop, Arthur Owens, Joseph Gebhardt, Emmanuel Fernandez, Gordon Belgrave, Dewey Bashir, Leo Kantrowitz. I just picked those at random, my good friends, to give you an idea of some of the people who would still be in government tonight or in defense plans if the left-wingers had their way.
The once feared voice of Joseph McCarthy, Republican of Wisconsin. To join our discussion, give us a phone call. 800-989-TALK, our email address, TOTN@NPR.org. Our guest here in Studio 3A is Donald Ritchie, Associate Historian of the United States Senate. And joining us now is David Oshinsky, a professor of history at the University of Texas, the author of A Conspiracy So Immense, The World of Joseph McCarthy. He's with us by phone from Solbury, Pennsylvania. Thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Were there any clues in McCarthy's life story that would foretell his behavior in the McCarthy era?
I think they were. McCarthy was a remarkably aggressive, ambitious, and reckless young politician. He had risen through the ranks of Republican politics in Wisconsin, often running races for various offices in which he smeared the other candidate. He had gone into the Army as an intelligence officer, but when he came out, it was Tail Gunner Joe, the man who had fired more rounds against the Japanese than any tail gunner in history. In other words, he wildly embellished his war record. And as he became a very, very young senator, he never really obeyed the rules of seniority or good conduct and was kind of shunted aside by his colleagues as a troublemaker. So by the time Joe McCarthy discovers the lightning in the bottle, the communist issue that will bring him to the top, he is seen as someone who is not a team player and someone whose recklessness is well known by his colleagues.
Let me ask this next question in an email we got from Rody Hagen. What did his constituents think about his crusade? How come it took so long to stop him, and were any other senators also responsible?
Well, you have to understand that McCarthy did not occur in a vacuum. You had the Cold War raging. Much of Eastern Europe had fallen under Stalin's domination. China had fallen to the communists. Alger Hiss had been found guilty of perjury, but really espionage. The Russians had gotten an atomic bomb. The Korean War was just about to begin. So what you have is a country that is very frightened and that is looking for a simple explanation for a series of very complicated events. And McCarthy, I think, is very masterful at giving the American public a real sort of quick glimpse of what is wrong. And what McCarthy says is, the enemy is not in Moscow or Beijing. The enemy is in Washington, D.C. There are traitors in our midst who want the other side to win. I have the names. I have done the investigating. I will bring them out into the light of day and essentially kick and punch at them until we get rid of these people. So it's essentially a very good reading, I think, of the American public's anxiety. And once he hits on the communist issue in 1950, you have to realize he's a Republican. He's the junior Republican senator from Wisconsin. The Republicans have not been in national power for almost two decades. It's been Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal and Harry Truman and the Fair Deal. And every time the Republicans raise an issue, the Democrats talk about the Great Depression and selling apples on sidewalks and unemployment and the New Deal. And now the Republicans seem to have a comparable issue, and that is the Cold War is going badly. We're losing everywhere to the communists. And the reason is that the Democrats are soft on communism. And McCarthy, in a sense, becomes the point man for that Republican attack.
Donald Ritchie, one of the ironies is that, in a way, Joseph McCarthy was right. There were communists who were actively supplying information to the Communist Party of the USA and to Moscow. We've learned that since the release of the Venona transcripts and since the fall of the Soviet Union, and people have been through the files of the what's now was then known as the KGB. Yet he didn't find any.
He came late to this issue. The Venona transcripts, those were taken during the war, and they were deciphered immediately after the war. The Federal Bureau of Investigation was involved. There were witnesses who went before the House Un-American Activities Committee who provided evidence against espionage rings that were operating. There were a lot of investigations that went on before Senator McCarthy got started. Alger Hiss had been convicted before Senator McCarthy really got started. Julius Rosenberg was arrested the year that Senator McCarthy got started. These investigations take place in 1953, considerably after that period. And he, of course, was trying to argue that there was a much bigger conspiracy going on than any of the others had recognized and that he was going to reveal it.
Mm-hmm.
The other point I think that should be made, and Don is absolutely right, is that what the Venona paper showed and the KGB paper showed as well is that the main conduit of Soviet espionage in the United States was the American Communist Party. And by the end of World War II, through heavy surveillance and other means, the Communist Party had largely been decimated.
Let's go back to the phones. Our next caller is Jim, who joins us from Bethesda, Maryland.
Hi. Great show. I just had a couple quick questions. First, I was curious to what extent Senator McCarthy was motivated by anti-Semitism, given that a number of his victims were Jewish. The other is the extent to which the senator was pursuing this cynically. There is an account that I think Jessica Mitford had written a number of years ago where she describes some former Communist Party members who had been interrogated or been harassed by McCarthy being approached by him. Apparently he was drunk in a hotel, and essentially saying that, yeah, well, you know, this was all for show, whatever. I don't know if that was accurate or not, but I'll take my answer off the phone. Thank you.
Thanks for the questions. David Oshinsky?
Yes. As far as anti-Semitism, one of the remarkable things about McCarthy the demagogue was that he was absolutely free of racist and anti-Semitic diatribes.
An equal opportunity bully?
He was in many ways. And Roy Cohn, I think, is really the key on the anti-Semitic issue. Cohn had been a prosecutor in the Rosenberg case, and I knew Cohn well when I wrote my book, and I often thought that Cohn saw himself as the avenging Jewish angel. In other words, to show America that all Jews were not Julius Rosenberg, that there were patriots on the other side. And Cohn, therefore, in some ways, went after Jews in larger numbers, particularly places like Fort Monmouth. McCarthy, in terms of picking out a group ethnically or racially and saying these people are more likely to be communists, never, ever, ever made that charge. As far as his cynicism, I think Don and I may agree that he started out, I think, McCarthy in 1950, as simply a reckless, ambitious crusader looking for political gain and looking for publicity. But by the time these transcripts that we look at today in the 1953 and 54, it's kind of a different Joe McCarthy. I think it's a McCarthy who does believe in the communist conspiracy, does believe in his rhetoric, and is desperately going through dozens and dozens and eventually hundreds and hundreds of witnesses in search of the new Julius Rosenberg or Alger Hiss.
I agree very much with what David said. And it was interesting, it was George Sikulski, the Hearst columnist, who convinced McCarthy to hire Roy Cohn in 1953, mm-hmm. Arguing that that would help to defuse charges of anti-Semitism
right.
against his investigation. Roy Cohn was actually a Democrat working in the Truman Justice Department at the time that the Republican Senator McCarthy hired him. Ironically, at the end of these hearings, George Sikulski is one of the witnesses who's called into executive session
right.
during the whole Army McCarthy situation. to testify on his relationship with these people. But no, I agree that Senator McCarthy did not show any particular prejudice against any particular group. In fact, he was very much against the WASPs who ran the State Department, as far as he was concerned, and just about every group came under his scrutiny.
And not only Roy Cohn, but another attorney associated with the that committee was Robert Kennedy, and they both wrote books afterwards complaining about sloppy staff work. I mean, Kennedy resigned and eventually became the lawyer for the Democrats.
Yes, and they attacked each other in their books.
Yes, well, that too.
They didn't care for each other, and they're both 26 years old. They're both very ambitious, aggressive young attorneys, and Roy Cohn got to be the chief counsel, which is the job that Robert Kennedy had sought. It was a staff that served both the majority and the minority. It wasn't divided by party. But at one point early in the investigations, Robert Kennedy actually came to blows with Roy Cohn and resigned. And he came back the following year as the minority counsel for the Democrats. That was a requirement that the Democrats made to rejoin the committee after they'd walked out in protest of Senator McCarthy's tactics.
I also think that probably the best single hearing that McCarthy ever held, which had to do with trading with the enemy during the Korean War, was basically done and written by Robert F. Kennedy.
Email question from Joe in Oakland. How did the media treat Senator McCarthy, and why did everybody let him get away with such tactics? And I think, Donald Ritchie, you've spoken a great deal about how the leaks to the media after these secret hearings were a key part of his tactics.
By holding these hearings in secret, the senator was able to walk outside afterwards and explain to the reporters who had not been able to attend what had gone on inside the closed session. They usually didn't get to hear the witnesses' side of it until a few days later and sometimes a few weeks later. But the senator then was able to define what the story was, to use the loaded words that would turn up in the headlines the next day. The press was somewhat divided. There were a lot of skeptics in the press, but they basically felt as objective reporters they had to report what an important senator was saying and the major charges he was making. But it took a lot of effort to try to uncover what the truth was behind these charges. And in many cases, it was a long stretch between the time that the senator made his initial headlines and the point when the newspapers were able to come up with sort of an alternative version.
I think Don is right. The newspapers were very into what you'd call objective reporting in that era, which was he says it, you print it, it's up to the public to decide whether it's true or not. There was very little investigation of McCarthy's charges.
Yet these very tactics were unfair. I mean, he was coming out of these hearings and saying, he told these people not to talk to the press, and then talking to the press about them, smearing them, exaggerating their role, and then they had no recourse.
That is right. That is absolutely right. And the press knew it was, in fact, a conveyor belt for information that was false, but felt that there was little they could do about it. The other thing I would add on this, which I think is important as well, is that McCarthy was followed around by a press corps known as the Goon Squad. And these were hard-drinking reporters who looked upon McCarthy as someone they liked to be around personally. And they also believed that McCarthy was front page news every day, which is where reporters really want to find themselves. So there was a kind of very wild connection here. One critic called it phobophilia. He said the press was in love with its enemy.
We're talking about the release of previously secret transcripts of hearings held by Senator Joseph McCarthy 50 years ago. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And joining us now is Norma Barsman, a Hollywood writer who lived through the McCarthy era. She's written a memoir of her experience, The Red and the Blacklist, and she's with us by phone from her home in Beverly Hills. Good of you to join us.
Well, it's lovely to be here. Glad to hear what you're saying. I want to say a few things, correct a few impressions that people have. Many wrongly use the word McCarthyism for the whole period from 1947 through the 50s. And, of course, this is not so. From 1947 to 1952, it was HUAC over Hollywood, and that's really, I think, where McCarthy learned from. I think that
HUAC, of course, was the House Un-American Activities Committee.
Yes. And when you realize that from 1947 to 52, HUAC over Hollywood, it was almost like a blueprint for McCarthy. You know, HUAC held secret hearings, too, in Hollywood. I don't know, it's not well known, but some senators came out here, bullied and badgered prospective witnesses, The hearings were supposed to be off the record, but the secret testimony was used to bludgeon the witnesses with threats of perjury, jail, and sometimes deportation. By the way, you can find a lot of this in the best book about the Hollywood blacklist, The Inquisition in Hollywood, by Larry Sinclair and Stephen England. But anyway, I mean, just to substantiate what I'm saying about the secret hearings, people don't know much about them. But I think McCarthy learned from HUAC many, many things. To level charges, that people were acting subversively when there was no evidence. I think he learned, above all, how to handle the press and TV. And you have to remember that TV was brand new in 1947 when the HUAC hearings showed celebrities losing everything, going to jail, the Hollywood 10. TV enthralled the public and put the fear of the Lord into the American people.
And remember that TV and radio were also being, I guess, intimidated is probably the right word, red channels.
Yes, that's a good word. Everybody was being intimidated, and I like to go back to someone put a sheet of paper in my hand at the Santa Fe conference commemorating the 50th anniversary of the making of Salt of the Earth. And this sheet of paper told me, had quotes from Goebbels saying that you can lead the people anywhere and into anything if you terrorize them enough.
Norma, would you just briefly tell us a bit about your story? We just have a minute or so left.
Oh, I see. Well, I did my book, The Red and the Blacklist, while it tells our story, the years we spent in Hollywood, the 40s, with the progressive community, and it does a great job. I think there's no other book that tells as accurately and as honestly and as intimately really what went on in the progressive community in Hollywood, what we did, and which was why HUAC went for us and why the studios backed the blacklist, went along with it. We really were, idealist, courageous, but we did many things for, you know, when you think of about a little over 400 people really being responsible, really being the center of the progressive movement in the United States, the 30s and the 40s, what did we do? We made humanist films, anti-racist, democratic, about real people, feminist before their time. What did we really do that the studios hated so? We organized the guilds and unions. We struck for all the things that are taken for granted now, medical care, pensions, all the other benefits. So, you know, Lester Cole and John Howard Lawson, the people in the Hollywood 10, were the ones who were active in their unions, in their guilds and unions.
Norma Barsman, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you.
Norma Barsman, the author of The Red and the Blacklist. More of your questions about the McCarthy era when we come back from a short break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow, a history of child rearing in America. Apparently, getting contradictory advice has a long tradition. That's tomorrow on Talk of the Nation. Today, we're talking about the McCarthy era and its influence on American government and culture. Eventually, public and official opinion turned against Senator McCarthy. Let's hear a portion of the Army-McCarthy hearings from 1954, an exchange between Senator McCarthy and the chief counsel for the Army, Joseph Welch, about a young lawyer.
Have you no sense of decency, sir, at long last? Have you left no sense of decency?
I know this hurts you, Mr. Welch.
May I say,
Mr. Chairman, as a point of personal privilege, I'd like to finish this.
Senator, I think it hurts you too, sir.
I'd like to finish this. Mr. Welch here has been filibustering this hearing. It seems that Mr. Welch is pained so deeply, he thinks it's improper for me to give the record, the Communist Front record, of the man whom he wanted to foist upon this committee.
The man referred to by Senator McCarthy was Frederick Fisher, a Harvard Law graduate who had recently joined Welch's firm. If you'd like to join our conversation, our phone number is 800-989-8255. The email address is totn@npr.org. Our guests are Associate Senate Historian Donald Ritchie and McCarthy biographer David Oshinsky. And I wanted to read an email we got from David Eddy in Needham, Massachusetts. I was 7 years old in 1954 when my father, a Yale Harvard educated economist, was hauled before a U.S. Treasury loyalty hearing board for having known several of the people whose testimony I've read for the first time in the recent release. My father was a nobody, a low-level policy wonk in the Treasury, but because he'd gone to graduate school with people that J. Edgar Hoover's favorites, Whitaker Chambers and Elizabeth Bentley, accused of communist ties, my father's career as an economist ended prematurely in 1954. The family costs have been terrible. My mother was eventually driven to attempt suicide. The good news is that my father's papers will be available soon at Harvard for a fresh generation of researchers who will be able to further document how totally out of control Hoover's FBI was. And David Oshinsky, another reminder that what we call the McCarthy era covered a large number of people.
Yes, it did. And I think that what we're going to find out with the release of these transcripts is more and more cases, just like the awful one that was repeated by your email person there. I think that we have no idea at this moment the depth of the McCarthy era, even after all of this study, or how many people really were hurt. The one thing I will say, when you played the Fred Fisher incident with Joe Welch and Joe McCarthy, is that that is considered today to be the greatest piece of unrehearsed theater of the hearings. But in fact, Joe Welch had rehearsed it very well. A deal had been made in which Joe Welch's camp would not bring up Roy Cohn's various draft evasions, and the McCarthy side would not bring up Fred Fisher. But McCarthy could simply not hold to his part of the bargain. Welch knew that he wasn't going to be able to hold to it, and therefore Welch had prepared remarks to deal with it, and the remarks, of course, were devastating. And what few people know, I interviewed Fred Fisher before he died, that is, Welch left the hearing room with tears in his eyes. As soon as he got away from the press, he sort of winked at Jim St. Clair, his second, and said, "How did I do?" And they said, "Very, very well."
Here's an email we got from Jeff Krull in St. Louis. Could you guests address Senator McCarthy's persecution of alleged perverts as well as communists and his equation of the two? Also, do your guests know of documentation regarding what anthropologist Marvin Harris called McCarthy's monumental hypocrisy, his and Roy Cohn's own homosexual involvements? And David Oshinsky, would that go to you?
Well, I'll make a stab at it. McCarthy always did talk about lace handkerchief types in the State Department. He accused Dean Acheson of being the red dean of fashion, in other words, of these people being effeminate and homosexuals. And there were hearings held in 1950 about homosexuality in the State Department, and McCarthy did not take part in those. There were all kinds of rumors in the 50s that McCarthy was homosexual, that Cohn and Shine were having a relationship and the like. And I think that those rumors, to some extent, forced McCarthy into an early marriage to his secretary, Jean Kerr. There is absolutely no evidence that McCarthy was homosexual.
Considerably more about Roy Cohn, though.
There was. And Cohn, in fact, was gay, died of AIDS late in life, and was kind of outed, I thought, in a fairly despicable way by the press. But there is no evidence of a Cohn-Shine amorous relationship.
Okay. Let's go to Jim, who joins us from Chico, California.
Thanks for taking my call. This week I saw an excellent movie, The Quiet American, which dramatized the CIA role of inserting the need for the United States military investment in the war on communism. And that drama was set in the year 1953. McCarthy's political legacy as a brutal demagogue has allowed history to brand him as the sole villain of the era. His hearings destroyed the willingness of American media to express progressive political points of view. And after that mission was accomplished, McCarthy was discarded. I want to know who was pulling his strings, who profited from the intimidation of progressive ideas, and who benefited from the escalation of anti-communist paranoia.
That's a lot to bite off. Donald Ritchie, you want to take a shot?
Well, McCarthy did personify what was going on. I think he pulled his own strings in that sense. His party would have been very happy if he had restrained himself. They actually hoped that he would focus on corruption issues and on waste and contracts, which were the traditional venue of his committee. But he persisted in his anti-communist investigations. He persisted from a Democratic administration to a Republican administration. He was fighting one of the most popular men ever to sit in the White House, Dwight Eisenhower. He took on Eisenhower's army, which was the institution that Eisenhower held probably above anything else. There was a very strong self-destructive side to Joseph McCarthy, and it was not helped at all by the fact that he chose Roy Cohn as his counsel. Cohn was a young, ambitious man who exerted no restraint at all on Senator McCarthy. If the Senate had had a more mature chief counsel, some of the other candidates that he had considered actually might have channeled his investigation to more productive levels. But the rest of the government was afraid of Senator McCarthy, and they saw him as potentially dangerous to their own structure as well as to the witnesses.
I agree with that. I would add, however, that had there been no Joe McCarthy and some like him, like Pat McCarran, it is very possible that the State Department would have had more reasonable minds in the late 50s and early 60s when Vietnam was coming about. In other words, the State Department was clean to some degree of those who held more progressive views vis-a-vis Asia and other places. So I think you can at least make the argument that although McCarthy was a renegade and worked alone, that his impact on State Department policy simply in making people fearful of what they thought and cleaning out the so-called radicals may have had a disastrous impact on American foreign policy in the next decade.
We just have a little bit of time left, but I wanted to ask this email question from Angie King. Did anything positive come out of the McCarthy sessions, Don Ritchie?
As far as Congress is concerned, the Senate and the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations rewrote their rules to prohibit many of the tactics that the senator was using during that stretch. The one-man shows, the subpoenas that came out in the middle of the night, many of the tactics of a barrage of questions at witnesses. And the Supreme Court then in 1957 also upheld the constitutional rights of all witnesses before congressional investigations.
And David Oshinsky, lessons to be learned as, again, we look at for enemies within.
Yeah, I think the lesson is that there's always a very delicate balance between liberty and security. And you have to be very, very careful of not trying to lose one at the expense of another. I agree with Don. I think McCarthy taught us an awful lot. I don't think Joe meant to do it, but in terms of what the Supreme Court does, Congress's ability now to rein in renegade senators, and the press being so much more aggressive in its treatment of demagogues and those who are looking for political gain, so much unlike what happened in the 50s, I think can give us positive pause. On the other hand, when you look back at the McCarthy era, vigilance is the key word.
David Oshinsky, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
David Oshinsky is the author of A Conspiracy So Immense, The World of Joe McCarthy. He was with us by phone from Solbury, Pennsylvania. And Donald Ritchie, I appreciate your coming in today.
Glad to be here.
Donald Ritchie, Associate Historian of the United States Senate. He was with us here in Studio 3A. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.